Hi, this is Joy from GetHiroshima.com. Have you ever wondered about raising your kids with more than one language? I had a chance to talk with Adam Beck of Bilingual Monkeys.
Hi, Adam.
Hi.
So can you talk a little bit about why you decided to write this book?
It started when I was a teacher at the Hiroshima International School.
Mm-hmm.
And I came in when the school was really quite small. It's still small, but I came in when it was very small. And there was no ESL program at all, so that was my task, really, is to start that. And that was an inspiring time for me, and I learned a lot about best practices, I think, working with bilingual, multilingual kids. And I also put together, you know, I was part of the Bilingualism Special Interest Group, so This was the first publication I helped put together for the Bilingualism SIG, for JALT.
For JALT, yeah.
Yeah, so this is some time ago now, but it was at that time that, you know, the seeds were planted, if you will, for more.
Mm-hmm.
And so after I left the school in 2005, I think, so it's been 10 years now, but I continued teaching children from the school privately. So my connection with these bilingual, multilingual children continued, you know, right here, or at the time I was living near the international school. And then my own two children, you know, eventually came along. So at that point, too, I had, if you recall, I was doing, you know, other kinds of work, Hiroshima
mm-hmm.
Starship. I started a different kind of organization. But finally, I gravitated back because it was a through line for everything I was doing, really, as a teacher and as a parent. So I started Bilingual Monkeys, a blog, and that grew pretty quickly. And then I started a forum called the Bilingual Zoo because there was some call for more interaction among the among readers, among the audience. And so the audience now has, you know, apart from simply comments at the blog, there is a forum which is very active, and there are 560-some members at this point. So, you know, both websites are quite active, and combined at this point, they get over 100,000 page views every month. So there's a, you know, there's a big and interested audience. And through this work online, it was, I think, only natural that a lot of this kind of work came together into a more manageable book. And so that's what this book is, I think. It,
mm-hmm.
it tries to take the best of my experience as a teacher and parent over the past 20 years and brings it together in 310 pages.
Yeah. Well, I found it really inspiring and full of motivational ideas for parents trying to raise their kids bilingually. I know, you know, for us as well, living in Japan but speaking English at home, there's always challenges.
Right. And certainly.
Yeah, I think a lot of people can identify with a lot of the stories and things that you bring up.
You know, every family has different circumstances. Your circumstances, well, we're all unique in our own ways.
Mm-hmm.
You're a little more unique than many other families in your situation, so you have your own particular challenges,
mm-hmm.
as we all do. But I think it's a question of basically, you know, looking hard, looking in a clear-eyed way at our circumstances. What are our basic circumstances, our basic conditions, and what are our aims? And then matching our efforts in the most strategic and productive way we can, and, you know, persevering in these efforts day by day over time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in that way, you know, I'm summing this up in a simple way, and it's much harder to live out day
mm-hmm.
by day, but I think that's the essence of the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's, yeah, lots of good advice and motivational stuff. I think no matter what your home situation, I would say, if you're thinking of bilingualism in a one-language culture or in
right.
a bilingual situation like many of us in Japan.
Well, yeah, certainly what I've learned over the years, particularly from interacting with so many people around the world, is this idea that every family is different. And I'm not trying to espouse a certain way that everyone should follow, because that won't necessarily be the most effective way for every family. Of course not. What I am saying, as I mentioned just a moment ago, is that every family needs to look very carefully at their own situation and then match, as effectively as they can, match their efforts so they can meet those particular conditions and their own particular aims. And what I think the book is, what I suggest the book is a big buffet of ideas that people can pick and choose from to match their own situation or inspire them to try and maybe, try to alter to match their situation even better. So that's what I hope the book can do, and the feedback I continue to receive, not only from the book, but really from the blog and the forum, is that it's this kind of more open-ended approach, offering a lot of ideas. Mm-hmm. Ideas and inspiration is what the blog is about, but that's what the book is about, too. It's about, you know, offering ideas and inspiration for people to, you know, look carefully at their own conditions and then make choices and take actions that would be most effective, what they think will be most effective for them.
Yeah, that's great. Right. I think that's the best way to do it, because everybody's situation is so varied and
inherently
distinct, yeah, right?
Inherently.
That's great. I was inspired by a lot of the stories and personal information that you gave in the book, especially the story of Seize the Day, and how you talked about a friend who is not ready to die. Can you explain that?
Well,
why you felt that was a good anecdote to add to the book? I mean, I personally, it kind of woke me up to the idea that, yeah, you know, if you want bilingualism or if you want a certain relationship with your kids, or there's no time like the present.
Well, absolutely. I think it applies to absolutely everything. You know, and I tried to underscore that in the book. It's not simply about, you know, the book is about raising bilingual children, so that's really the point I'm trying to make. But at the same time, you know, making the most of every day is at the heart of living a fulfilling life, no matter what we want to do, I think. And the fact remains that if it's about raising bilingual children, this is a very long process.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't make the most of every day, I don't think we should be surprised when farther down the road we're not as really far along as we thought we wanted to be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I really think it's essential to be mindful about, you know, how we're using our time. Yes, on one hand, for raising bilingual children, because I think it requires that sort of daily persistence. But larger than that, really, I think that whole idea, about making the most of our days and our lives, is essential for just our life itself. And and let me back up, because I'm speaking so abstractly, but this came about, and I explained this in the book, but it came about because I had a friend who I used to work with on some, like a volunteer type project. And we were close in our working relationship, but we didn't really socialize outside of that. And anyway, when we kind of drifted away from that work, from that volunteer activity, I didn't see him very often because we did not socialize outside that scene, let's say. And so when I finally did cross paths with him a couple years later, back at that volunteer activity, and he told me he had cancer, but he was not ready to die, as he said, it kind of hit me hard, certainly. And it hit me hard also in kind of a unique way, because he actually had the very same birthday as I do. I mean, not just the same day, but the same year. We were born, you know, on that same day. And so he was the same age as me. And the fact that he had cancer, that kind of shook me and woke me up to some extent. And, you know, we made plans to meet, and, you know, those sorts of plans didn't come to pass. And when I learned less than a year later that he had died, you know, I kicked myself for not making more of an effort to to meet him. Mm-hmm. And I regret that. And I can only say that I think since that time, I've been more mindful of how quickly our lives are passing. And, you know, I think when we're younger, and certainly our kids, and when we were kids, we felt the same way. You know, life seems to go on forever, and the days certainly seem to go on forever at times for all of us. But the point is, that's not the case. And as you get older, that becomes, I become keenly aware of that, very keenly aware of that. And it's present, it's a present part of me day by day now. And so I don't think I see that in any sort of panicky way, but I see that for me, what that means is that in terms of my own children, putting aside the bilingual aspect of it, but that's important, putting aside that, it's how do I make the most of my time with them? Mm. You know, how do I really, how can I stay mindful of that? Mm. And, you know, when I'm gone, how do I want them to remember me? Mm-hmm. You know, what will they think about me? And what will their memories be? And what will they pass on if and when they do have their own children? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it goes so much, it goes well beyond my own lifetime into future generations, I think, really. Mm-hmm. And when we're talking, just getting back to bilingualism, when we're talking about, you know, nurturing languages in children, we're talking about changing the future, if you will, because mm-hmm. the fact that they have, you know, more than one language, in this case two, maybe three, they're studying Spanish now, but the point is that this additional ability not only impacts their own life in fundamental ways, but because of that ability, it can impact the world and it can ripple out farther and farther into the world, not only through their own descendants, but also all the people that they come in contact with throughout their lives. So it really, it's a meaningful thing, not only today, but it's a very meaningful thing for tomorrow. And it's not, you know, it's not just true for me, but what I get, and this is kind of the bottom line, I think, for many families, is that, you know, this is a, yes, we can talk about it's, you know, economically beneficial, all the other kinds of things that people often think of when they, oh, he's bilingual, you know, what a great thing, you know, economically or for their future employment. But, you know, I think much, much deeper than that, it's simply very, very important and meaningful at a basic family and human level. And if my children were unable to communicate with me in my mother tongue, I would simply feel that they couldn't really know my soul. Mm-hmm. That's the way I would feel.
Yeah. Well, that's a beautiful thing, I think, that you put that story, it's very personal, but that you've put it in the book, you're honoring him and that memory, and I think it wakes a lot of people up, like me, you know, who reads that, and you think, what is my legacy with my kids? Not just about language, but about a lot of things. Absolutely. So I really appreciated that story. Thank you. Mm. A lot of your ideas and concepts in the book really hinge on the motivation and passion of the parents as the teachers. But I hear from a lot of people that their kids aren't interested. But then in the book as well, you have this great part about your kid wants to be bilingual. Like, could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think it's true. I think all we have to do is kind of take this as a thought experiment. You know, I think there are many children, you know, it's not just about being bilingual. We could talk about piano or many other things that parents are, you know, nudging their children toward. But, you know, if we polled the world of adults, and we ask them the question, you know, do you regret becoming bilingual? I think the percentage that would say that they regret that would be exceedingly small, right? And so my point is, and I go a little bit farther in the book with this, but the point is for this thought experiment, and we can go all the way back, I think, when the baby is born, but the idea is that the child, even when they're small and they have no idea what being bilingual could potentially mean to them, and even when they're kind of resistant to the whole notion, we can talk more about resistance in a minute. But when they're resistant to that, I think what we need to do is continue to persevere past that, because I don't believe ultimately, again, if we project into the future and think of them as adults, I don't think we're the only ones that hope that they will be bilingual. I think that the adult within them wants to be bilingual too. That's how I would say it. And I think that's true. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of resistance, however, you know, there's a whole other kind of, side to that. And I think the idea, resistance often rears its uncomfortable head when the balance is off between being serious about it and being playful about it. I think it's a delicate balance.
Yeah.
And I think it's extremely important to get that balance right and try to sustain that balance over time. There's no getting to some perfect place, because there's this constant evolution, because the children are growing, we're changing, our environment and our circumstances will likely change over time too. But my point is, what is my point?
Resistance
So
motivation.
But, yes, but we need to maintain that sense of be very serious, be very playful. Because, you know, at heart, you know, what children gravitate toward is playfulness. That's their inherent nature. You know, that's how they learn about the world, through play. And if we can meet them on those terms and make things as playful as possible, we don't necessarily, and another thing I would just kind of connect to in the book is the idea that we don't really need to teach them much necessarily. Mm-hmm. If we provide a context of playfulness and joy, they will gravitate towards that and they will engage with us in this process. And so I think when there is this kind of resistance, I think what parents need to do is step back and think about what is their balance between being serious about this, which is important, but also how playful are they being with their children? And if they can kind of, you know, turn that balance or you know, reweight that balance more towards play, it doesn't mean we're only playful and not serious, because I don't think that the kids will take us seriously either. I think the balance has to be there and our expectations have to be firm. But if we, you know, if we can engage them each day in playful ways, then I think they will more easily join us on this journey together.
So it's not like finishing that certain amount of homework every day. It's not like finishing enough studying so you pass the test. It's more, I mean, a way to spend time with your kids in an enjoyable way.
Well, I think it's both, because I do think, again, it depends on, you know, particular circumstances and aims. I can only speak for myself at the moment, but, you know, my aim is high. I would like them to have bilingual ability, both being able to communicate well in Japanese and English, but also reading and writing at a educated level. And to do that, you know, they attend the Japanese school, so essentially the Japanese side of their literacy is provided for by the school and through the homework that they do each day. And, you know, and my wife supports that process. And you know, I don't understand what they're doing, but in terms of Japanese. But at the same time, if I don't have certain expectations and certain routines that are established and sustained in terms of advancing their literacy development in English, I don't think that would really happen, because they don't have, at this point at least, and haven't yet had any sort of academic opportunities, you know, schooling opportunities in English. So what does that mean? That means expectations in terms of doing daily homework. That's one of the main things. And there's things around that as well. But this rhythm, this routine of doing daily homework started when they were 3 and 4 years old with some kind of, you know, modest sorts of activities, dot-to-dot books, and I would continue reading with them. And it slowly kind of stretched and expanded from there based on their own growth, not only, you know, their maturity level, but also their growing language and literacy ability. So I wouldn't say it's... I hesitate to say that it's it's only this sort of playful engagement without this sort of clear structure, because I think it's both, at least in my case it is. And you know, we have these routines, particularly at the heart, this sort of this literacy routine with daily amounts of, manageable homework. So, you know, they do 10 or 15 minutes on reading and writing tasks day in and day out, and I prepare that in advance. And there's, you know, we need materials for this, right? So that's another constant thing that I think parents, any parent really needs to take on. They need to bring in resources into their home in that target language. And if there are not enough books, if there are not enough other sorts of resources which enrich the environment and help engage the child in that language, it becomes much more difficult. It's like I offer the metaphor in the book about, you know, you take two rooms, and one room is essentially empty of resources, and the other room is a kind of wonderland of inviting resources. You know, which room is a child going to spend more time in? You know, they may go in the first room first and shout and do echoes. They'll be into that for a while, but they'll gravitate to the other room and they'll engage with that room because there are resources, let's hope, if the parents are making suitable choices, that will engage them not only in their level of maturity, their age level, let's say, but, you know, also in their interests. Somehow. You know, if they like dinosaurs, well, you find exciting dinosaur books that would match their level of maturity and their interest. And you bring those into the home, and you continually do that over time. I mean, it's an ongoing process, and it can be tiring, I know. And I know I have the advantage of English because there's so much material in English. But be that as it may, whatever family, you know, whatever target language a family has, they have to commit to bringing resources into the home on a continual basis. And the richer they can make their environment, emphasizing that the minority language, while in many cases I would recommend de-emphasizing the majority language, I think the more productive that sort of situation will be.
Do you think it's important to try to keep up with their level of native speakers? So, for example, if they're fourth grade here, should they be doing fourth grade English, even though they're fourth grade Japanese? You know what I mean? Or,
well, you know, my children are on, I roughly know the levels, not only from, you know, materials that I use, workbooks and such. And I also, because I was a teacher at the international school, I basically know what children are capable of at certain ages and certain levels. So my goal, at least my personal goal, is to have them, if possible, to sustain or advance their development over time so they can roughly stay on par with their age level. It's not easy, but I do think it's possible if it's done in a consistent fashion day by day by day. And it's not just through the daily homework, but it's also through, you know, other sorts of strategies like captive reading, which I talk about, and I use the bathroom, and I have since the children were small, to starting with, you know, a whiteboard sticker and just single words, to now, you know, I copy and I blow up the pages, but, you know, I copy nonfiction books, two or three pages at a time, and it stays on the bathroom door for a couple days. And the point of all this over time is that, you know, it's all these different things. It's not one thing we do. It's everything we do from all these different angles. And if we can sustain all of that in playful ways over time, these things all add up in very significant ways. And so, you know, I wrote something the other day on my blog about this, but my son, I asked him to make a list. This was part of a homework task, but I asked him simply make a list, write a list of 10 things that are black. And I gave him some other colors too, but one list was black. And he came up with some interesting things, and he came up with the word nostril as well. Because the inside, I suppose, is black, right?
Yeah.
And he came up with some other interesting
things. It's pretty high level.
It's a pretty high level word, and not only did he know the word, but he spelled it correctly, and it's not easy to spell.
It is.
And he's 9 years old. So what I took from that, what I wrote about, I tried to blow that up and look at the fact that, you know, it's kind of like an iceberg. And what you see over time is the visible level that the child has reached. So what we see of his level at that moment in the fact that he was able to write these different words, including nostril, that lies above the water's surface. That's what we see. But underneath that, and most of the iceberg is underneath the water, what we don't see is the years of efforts, both mine and his, and all that language development that has grown over time. And that's what ultimately supports the rising of that kind of level. Otherwise, if the iceberg below hadn't been as firm and robust, or if it hadn't had that, he would not have been able to write or spell that word. So that's a real, to me, it's a symbolic, it's a symbol of all that went into our experience together in terms of bringing him to that moment in time in terms of his language ability. So, you know, is it necessary for a child to be at grade level? Of course not. It really depends on every family's situation and aims. Is it possible? Of course it's possible, but families, depending on their situation, they need to establish and sustain from an early age, I think, certain routines and habits that can productively move the children so their, you know, iceberg of bilingualism will eventually rise to that level over time.
And if you're in a situation where you haven't set up those principles from day one like you have, is it too late?
It's certainly never too late. It's never too late. And, you know, I work with families all the time online through the blog, through the forum, through email, and coaching situations as well, to try to turn things around or try to shore up or fortify what's happening in the home and outside the home, but really taking a more kind of global and holistic look at the situation. You know, where are the children now? And, you know, what's the situation in terms of the parents and their work and the time that they have and their, you know, the access to that language within their environment and resources and so on. And if we do that sort of global and holistic approach to it, I think we can always find ways to fortify the situation so that children make stronger progress over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another idea I came across in your book, which I thought was interesting, is the necessity to get to the native language being spoken naturally. And I think that's really hard in this day and age while flight prices are increasing and stuff. But in Japan, some recent changes have been happening, like House Tembosh in Nagasaki, they have an English village where everybody working there speaks only English. Uh-huh. There's cafes in Tokyo where the menus, everything, all the staff, everybody's doing English only. The Tokyo Olympics coming, there's a whole English village there as well. Mm-hmm. Do you think that kind of creating authentic English-speaking areas inside a non-English-speaking country, is that effective?
I say the more the merrier. I really do. That would be enormously helpful. You know, I think one of the challenges we face in Japan, most certainly, is that English is not really widely used. And that may be a bit different if you're in Tokyo and there's more access to these sorts of settings and situations and activities. But that's not so much the case here in Hiroshima, I think. And so that's a situation that is working against us, quite frankly. And if there were more opportunities like this that parents, families could theoretically take advantage of, then I think that would certainly would help, you know, strengthen their circumstances. Some people out in the, you know, in other countries, let's say Germany, you know, English is taught from a fairly early age there and taught well, and the young people, for the most part, you know, go through the school system and learn German, they learn German, but they learn English quite well too, for the most part. And if that was the case here, then I don't think I'd have to work quite so hard at this.
Neither of us would have jobs.
Yes, that's true. We didn't have work either. But it makes an enormous difference in terms of the level of efforts that we need to make. But again, that comes back to, you know, what are our inherent circumstances that we're working with, and you know, how proactive do we really need to be to achieve the scale of our aim? You know, if my aim was lower or my circumstances were more conducive to supporting their English or having the school support their English or society itself support their English, if that was the case, I don't think I would have to be as proactive as I have been for, you know, over a decade. But because that's not the case, what is my choice? Either to scale back my expectations for their language level, or to do essentially what I've been doing, which is taking it on and putting it, you know, making it a priority. It's a central part of our life. It's a lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being, you know, raising bilingual children, I think, particularly if you have high aims, is a lifestyle choice, or should be. Otherwise, what results is disappointment, I think.
Yeah.
So.
Well, this is a fabulous book, and I recommend people to pick it up and read it and see your website and blog and get lots of inspiration. And the next one, I assume, because your kids are getting older, will be Challenging the Teenage Years, right?
Well, I am working on another book. It's not necessarily about challenging the teenagers. I don't know if I'll survive that. But I'm working on some other things now, and there's just a lot happening, I think. And so I do encourage people to stop by Bilingual Monkeys and the Bilingual Zoo, and you'll find just, I think, you know, like I said before, a big buffet of ideas and inspiration. And you're welcome to contact me through the blog or the forum as well. So, you know, if you're listening to this and you're raising bilingual children, keep going. You know, what I like to say is there's always a payoff to perseverance. So persevere. I'm cheering for you. And thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Adam.